welcome back to the Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm Cale Clark, your host. We're continuing through this amazing chapter, chapter 11 of the book of Daniel. It is a real life Game of Thrones. The kings of the north, the kings of the south, winter is coming, all that good stuff. This is just wild prophecies about what was going on leading up to the time of Jesus Christ. So let's go back to Daniel 11 and pick up where we left off last time. And if you missed part one, you're definitely going to want to listen to that on relevantradio.com or the Relevant Radio app and stream that, share it with your friends. It's really exciting to dive into this. And let's look at Daniel chapter 11, verse 11. It says, "Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated." Okay, let's stop there. What on earth is this all about? Well, at the end of our last episode, we left off talking about one of the Seleucid rulers, the kings of the north, Antiochus III, who was also known as the Great. Antiochus the Great. Now, his son is one of the most evil characters in the entire narrative of salvation history in the Bible. We're going to get to him in just a minute or two. But I want to talk about verse 11 here, because that is describing this great battle between the king of the north at the time, Antiochus the Third, known as the Great, fighting against one of the kings of the south, Ptolemy the Fourth. Now, just to refresh your memory a little bit, this had to do with the breakup of Alexander the Great's kingdom of Greece. And remember, these four generals kind of took control of the four parts of the kingdom. Eventually, it boils down to the Seleucids in the north and the Ptolemaic dynasty in the south. So really what's going on here in verse 11, this is describing what came to be known as the Battle of Raphia in 217 BC. And just to set this up for you, and by the way, I'm following very closely the description of these events by Tremper Longman III and his wonderful commentary on Daniel. Just to set this up for you, just prior to this big Battle of Raphia, in 218 BC, Antiochus III, the Great, he was really advancing. His army was advancing in Syria. And in the winter, remember, winter is coming. It's like Game of Thrones. He set up his headquarters in Ptolemais. Now, the very next summer, and to be really exact about the date, it was June 22nd, 217 BC. This was the great Battle of Raphia between the southern kingdom, the Ptolemaic kingdom, Ptolemy the Fourth, fighting against the forces of the king of the north, Antiochus the Third. And this is really located, by the way, this battle was located in the southern part of what is known as Palestine, the Holy Land, the beautiful land, as it says in the book of Daniel. Well, in this case, Antiochus the Third got his clock cleaned in this battle. They really got pummeled. And so he had to backpedal. He had to retreat and go back to his capital city of Antioch. Now, the great mistake that Ptolemy the Fourth, the southern king, the great mistake that he made here was not pursuing Antiochus the Third and not sort of taking him out, wiping him out completely. He let him flee. He let Antiochus flee, and he went back home, kind of licked his wounds, regathered his forces for another battle. And that proved to be a big, big mistake for Ptolemy. Antiochus the Third built up his forces, and a few years later, he decided to once again set out and try to rebuild his kingdom, his lost lands. And then he got the absolute break of his life, because in the year 204 BC, Ptolemy the Fourth and his wife, the queen, died out of nowhere. They dropped dead. Ptolemy the Fourth, the king of the south, he was only 35 years old at the time. His son, who was supposed to take over for him, Ptolemy the Fifth, was only 6 years old. So he's not ruling anything right now. He's playing with his toys. While this young kid was growing up, high officials were ruling the kingdom in his place, including some of the generals. So Antiochus III, he felt this is the time to strike. I'm going to invade the southern kingdom. I'm going to try to reclaim some lands. Well, the first incursion that Antiochus made, it didn't go very well. There was a general by the name of Scopas for the southern kingdom, and he defeated Antiochus. But then, in 200 BC, another battle took place at a place called Panium. And you might know it better. It is a city, it is a town that is mentioned in the Gospels, Caesarea Philippi. And that's, of course, where Peter correctly identified Jesus as the Messiah, and where Jesus said, "Peter, you are the rock, and on this rock I will build my church." So you know it better as Caesarea Philippi. And this great battle that took place there in 200 BC, Antiochus III the Great just absolutely routed the southern forces. And this is how the Holy Land of Palestine came under the control of the Seleucid Empire, the Northern Kingdom. And this proved to be very, very crucial in salvation history. Now let's go back to the text. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 11, starting with verse 11. "Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands, yet he will not remain triumphant, for the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army fully equipped." That's basically narrating what I just told you. All right, let's go now to verse 14 in Daniel chapter 11. "In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and will build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back upon him. After this, he will turn back toward the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle." Okay, let's stop there for a second. What on earth does this mean? And of course, don't forget, this is a prophecy that's given by an angel from heaven to Daniel back in the 6th century BC about times that are coming. So let's go back to what this is really all about here. Okay, so if you look at verse 14 very closely, "In those times many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success." Admittedly, this is a pretty obscure verse, but all of these things that are happening, all these great wars between the kings of north and south, the Jewish people living in the Holy Land, living in Jerusalem, are kind of caught in the middle. They're kind of caught in the crossfire. And so it says, "The violent men among your own people." Remember, he's talking to Daniel, this angel, so he's talking about the Jews. "The violent men among your own people will rebel." Will rebel. Now, we're not quite sure what this is referring to, but as Longman says, there were a lot of power plays, politically speaking, going on in Jerusalem at the time. A lot of it had to do with who was running the high priesthood. The Oneads controlled the high priesthood at the time, and they actually wanted the southern kingdom, especially the Egyptians, to kind of rule over them. But there was a really wealthy family in Jerusalem known as the Tobiads, and they had a lot of pull. And in fact, they were kind of related through marriage to the Oneads, who are controlling the high priesthood. Now, they wanted the opposite thing to happen. The Tobiads wanted the northern kingdom Antiochus the Great. They wanted him ruling over them. So when the angel says they will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, we're not quite sure what this means, but it may mean that they tried to take things into their own hands, but they weren't successful. Anyways, just keep that in mind, this infighting going in with Jerusalem, with the high priesthood. It's a lot of political intrigue here. This whole thing really could be a movie. It maybe should be a movie. Well, at this point, Antiochus III, he did not make the same mistake that his counterpart made earlier when he defeated Scopas, the general that was in charge of the south. He pursued him, and he didn't give up until he got all the way to Sidon. Now, Sidon, of course, is a biblical city. It's mentioned by Jesus in the Gospels, Tyre and Sidon. You know about that. And so that's probably what verse 15 is all about when it says, "Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand." In all likelihood, that is a reference to Antiochus III pursuing the general Scopas, getting all the way down to Sidon. And J.J. Collins, a great biblical scholar, he thinks that the best troops that are here, even they are not able to stand against him, that probably refers to the famous Aetolian mercenary troops of the general Scopas. But at any rate, this is the great victory of Antiochus. He gets really, really far down into the southern kingdom. And it probably starts to go to his head a little bit, all this great military success. Here's what Daniel says it's the angel speaking to Daniel, of course, but this is Daniel chapter 11, verse 16. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. Now, this is what's going on here. Antiochus actually meets a pretty bad end. We're going to talk about this later on, but right now he's setting himself up in the beautiful land, and we know that is the Holy Land of Palestine. So how does he establish himself there? Well, he takes a strategy that's really from the ancient playbook. He decides to get some political alliances going through marriage, through marrying people off and trying to create political alliances. His daughter, Cleopatra, not the Cleopatra that you know, but a Cleopatra who is a daughter of Antiochus III, he actually marries her off to the one who's going to be the ruler of the south, Ptolemy V. Remember, that was the six-year-old way back when? Well, he's now grown up. He is a marriageable age. He is now the ruler of the southern kingdom. And so Antiochus says, I'm going to give my daughter in marriage to him. We'll make a deal, and everything is going to be fine. He was kind of hoping that Cleopatra, his daughter, would be kind of a spy for him in the southern kingdom, but it didn't turn out that way. It didn't turn out that way. In fact, Cleopatra decides to side with her husband against her dad, and she becomes the leader in the south. She becomes the leading, most powerful figure in the south, in Egypt, because her husband died in the year 182 BC. So she becomes the ruler, and then her son, Ptolemy VI, becomes the king of the south 8 years later. All right, so a little side story for you there. But Antiochus III the Great, he was incredibly ambitious, and he was always trying, nothing was ever enough for this guy. He was always trying to expand his kingdom more and more. Let's take a look at verse 18 of Daniel chapter 11. It says, "Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back upon him." Let's look at verse 19. "After this, he will turn back toward the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more." And here we have the fate of Antiochus III. What was going on here? Well, just like the prophecy in the 6th century says, he tries to expand among the coastlands. What was he doing? He was trying to take parts of Asia Minor and make them into annexed sections of his kingdom. He also tried to capture some of the Greek islands. In the year 196 BC, He actually went as far as trying to encroach on Thrace. And guess what? This definitely got the attention of the Roman Empire, which was the dominant world power at that time, was really, really on the rise. And so Antiochus, unfortunately, got on the Romans' radar screen. They were paying attention to his activities, but as he started to aggressively expand, they said, we've got to do something about this guy. Maybe a modern-day example would be how Russia annexed Crimea recently, and world leaders are really perking up, saying, what is going on here? Aggressive expansion is happening. How can we curtail this? What should we do about this? Well, the Romans decided to act when it came to Antiochus III. They had warned him several times to stop trying to militarily expand his kingdom. So eventually the Roman Senate sent a consul to fight against him, and his name was Lucius Cornelius Scipio. He defeated Antiochus at the Battle of Thermopylae in 191 AD, and once again, only a year later, defeated him again at Magnesia in the year 190. Seems like Antiochus had a little bit of amnesia. He's like, oh, this guy beat me once. Maybe I forgot how good he was. He gets beaten again. So he has to backpedal once more. And things really end badly for him. He who was once known as the Great, at the end of his life, he started stealing precious materials from a temple, a pagan temple, in order to survive. He died in the year 187 BC. Okay, so his son is kind of mentioned in the next verse here, verse 20. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. Well, that's a reference to Antiochus' son, Seleucus IV. He was really unpopular. He put a huge tax burden on the people to try to keep the Romans away. You know, they thought, well, we'll just pay them a lot of tribute and they won't bother us. And so that he was incredibly unpopular, and he died under very mysterious circumstances. We don't quite know exactly whether someone murdered him or not, but this really opened the door for his younger brother to take over the northern kingdom, the kingdom of the north. And his name was someone, well, we've talked about him a lot on this program, someone who you probably know very, very well, one of the most evil, most horrific rulers that's ever mentioned in the pages of the Bible, Antiochus IV, who got the nickname of Epiphanes, which means divine manifestation. This guy had an ego the size of Manhattan. And boy, did he cause a lot of untold damage and just unbelievable wickedness that he brought about for the people of God. This is what Daniel talks about in the next few verses here. Let's go back to Daniel 11, starting at verse 21. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Here's Daniel 11, 21 and following. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a very large and powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the South again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword, or be burned, or captured, or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. Okay, so let's stop there at verse 35. This is a very detailed prophecy, as you can see, made in the 6th century BC, and some people disagree about that. They think it was made after the fact, written after all these historical things happened. I don't necessarily think that's the case. We'll talk about that in just a little while. But I think it's a real prophecy. And what are these verses really all about? Again, they're about what the text calls the contemptible person, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He greatly offended the Jews, and he became really the symbol, kind of a paradigm or icon of the kind of power that tries to exalt itself, disregarding God entirely. And so he's really, in many ways, a foretaste of the ultimate Antichrist who is to come. He is a type of Antichrist, and we're going to talk about the Antichrist because that's what's really at the end of this chapter, a future prophecy about something that's even more down the line, the Antichrist. But before we do that, let's talk about Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now, there's some people that disagree about the meaning of verses 22 to 24, but John Collins thinks that really it's kind of more a general statement about how Onias the Third was deposed from being the high priest. I think I agree with that, and so does Tremper Longman. What about verse 23? It's a little bit unclear. It's a little bit unclear as to what this is talking about. It says, after coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully. With only a few people, he will rise to power. I'm not quite sure what this is about. It might be about how Antiochus Epiphanes gained influence in Jerusalem, but here's how he did that. Here's how he got so much influence. Well, Onias the Third was the high priest at the time. And don't forget, our modern fetish of separating church from state, that is not part of the ancient world. There is really no separation between church and state. So the high priesthood in Jerusalem, not only was that incredibly important from a religious point of view, but also from a political point of view. This was a high political office. Now, Onias III, the high priest at the time, he was for the south. He was pro-Egyptian. And remember that rich family in Jerusalem that I talked about, the Tobiads? Well, they really were power brokers in Jerusalem at the time. They were not native to Jerusalem. They immigrated to Jerusalem. And they actually were kind of pro-northern kingdom. They were pro-Syrian, pro-Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. They really wanted him to succeed in his rule. So there was kind of a relative that was kind of part of both families. Jason was the brother of Onias the Third, the high priest. So he's really a part of the high priestly family. And the Tobiad family really basically pulled off some political maneuvers and got Onias III removed as high priest, got Jason installed. Now, Jason was kind of on the side of the north. He was on the side of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And this did not go over well with the Jewish population. They were really, really upset that the sacred office of the high priest could be bought and sold, could be moved around in this way. And so this is really what the text mentions in Daniel chapter 11 in verse 24 when it says this. It says, when the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. This idea that Antiochus the Fourth is kind of behind the overthrow of fortresses, what does that mean? Getting one high priest deposed, getting him out of office, and getting a man of his own choosing put in. So that's really the background here to what's going on. Okay, let's go back to verse 25 in Daniel 11. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. So what's going on here is that Antiochus IV Epiphanes decides to fight a war in the tradition of his dad against the south. Now remember Cleopatra, who was the daughter of Antiochus's dad, tried to get this political alliance going. Cleopatra married the southern king, Ptolemy V. And remember, Cleopatra's son, Ptolemy VI, eventually took over. He had two advisors, and they were really pulling all the strings behind the scenes. They were the power behind the throne. Their names were Iulius and Lennius. They were anti-Northern Kingdom. And really, they did not like Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And so Antiochus realized this, and he said, you know what? I'm going to strike first. I'm going to rise and strike first because it's kill or be killed out here. I know they're plotting a war against me. I'm going to take charge of the situation. So a battle formed, and south of Gaza, this really took place. Antiochus routed the southern forces. Now, Ptolemy VI, who was the actual ruler of the south at the time, kind of took the blame, but really, all the blame should be placed on the shoulders of these two advisors, Iulius and Lennius. That's why in verse 26, it says this of Daniel 11, those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. Because of these two advisors, they were the ones who got the southern king in trouble. Those are the ones who ate from the king's provisions, ate from the king's table, but really they're to be blamed for this whole mess. All right, well, what happened after this? More drama. And this leads us up to the time of the Maccabees, very close to the time of Jesus Christ. Antiochus's evil will truly know no bounds, but I will share that with you in the next episode. That's it for today. We have run out of time, but a little history bite for you. Pretty exciting stuff. A real life Game of Thrones, North and South. I'm Cale Clark. Thanks for listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. We'll be back tomorrow with more from the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. Share it with a friend. God bless you. See you then.